They used to tell me about the land of the free, and I believed what they said. Just mention Roosevelt or Washington, Lincoln or Jefferson, and a tear would be shed. They used to tell me about the red, white, and blue, and I would fight any foe. So why am I just wasting away in Guantanamo? Once I made a phone call overseas, then they made it a crime. When I made a phone call, they spied on me. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I marched in protest, opposed to war, I sang and carried a sign. You can't march in protest anymore, brother, can you spare a dime? When came my arrest, I was detained. There was no judge, no jury, no trial. Could not call a lawyer, so here I've remained. Disappeared a long while. Oh, say when I was tortured, yeah, I confessed, but I was out of my mind. They'd call Yankee Doodle a terrorist. Big brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Only 15 Years to End Civilization's Energy Failures with Tom Ashbrook and his guests.
So for Americans, paint a bit of a picture for us here. When we're always trying to imagine what it would mean to step up and actually do this. How much would, I don't know, we're talking serious change here, challenging change, as you say. How much would affect lifestyle, standard of living, manner of living? Try and translate it into a picture that people can imagine and buy into or not.
Okay, well, let me give you one example that might be useful. I think one very robust result from research across the scenario sort of literature that I work with is that a core part of any strategy is a decarbonization of electricity. That means when we say decarbonization, we're no longer producing carbon from electricity, but only using renewables, fossil energy with CCS, nuclear power, and so forth. Mm-hmm. You know, around 2050. So over the next, say, 35 years, we're really going to replace all of the emitting technologies we have with non-emitting technologies. And, of course, those are more expensive. And if they're more expensive, then that means higher electricity prices. So that's one sort of thing that you would see. But also, depending on how optimistic or pessimistic we are about it, you know, we may be talking about more efficient cars, whether it's through CAFE standards or new technologies. We could be talking electric cars, which would use the new electricity sources, more efficient homes, and so forth. So it's a range of measures.
Rob Stavins, picture that, replacing all carbon-emitting electricity production technologies by 2050. What does that mean in terms of cost to businesses, to citizens? Does it mean we're eating gruel and living in huts? Are we living sort of like now, simply to have different sources of energy? How do you picture it, Rob?
Well, I mean, two things would happen. One is that, as Leon correctly said, the price of electricity will increase substantially, and that's just simply because if you ignore climate change impacts, coal is essentially extremely cheap. It's now competing in the United States with natural gas, but the U.S. is quite unusual in that regard. Mm-hmm. And renewable sources of power, whether, you know, wind, solar, et cetera, and for that matter, nuclear power, which is carbon-free, are much, much more expensive. The costs will vary tremendously. You know, to take one of the poster child industries, cement production. Cement production involves both a lot of energy use, so there's that those emissions, but also the process itself generates CO2. So you'd see massive increases in the price of cement produced by current methods.
Okay.
In a growing economy, take China as an example, or any of the emerging economies in the developing world, where you're putting in a lot of new infrastructure, a lot of construction, that's exceptionally important. I think the main thing for listeners to keep in mind is that when we say that it's increasing the cost of various industries, that means increasing the cost of producing goods and services, and that means increasing costs to all of us. We're buying those goods and services. So there isn't some kind of free lunch that we're going to push off costs onto industry and manufacturing. We're going to feel it.
Climate policy is not a free lunch. We heard that right at the news conference in Berlin on Sunday. Rob Stavins, Leon Clark, please stand by. Let me begin to bring our listeners in. Daniel in Jasper, Indiana. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a comment, I guess. I think that I'm actually a very strong green advocate, and I am also a coal miner. I'm probably the only one out there.
Okay. Rare combination, coal miner and green advocate, but there you are, Daniel. What do you think, then, in that situation?
Well, the guys that I work with, and they fight for those jobs. Mm-hmm. The jobs that they have, they fight for them because they can make $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year, and they only need a... 2-week education to get it, 2-week safety training.
Right, so no college degree or PhD required, just 2 weeks and in.
No, that's it. That's all you need.
Yeah.
And they make that kind of money, and that's why they fight for those jobs. They get 100% insurance. They fight very hard for those jobs because of that.
Yeah.
And if we could find a way, I'm into coal mining because of out of necessity, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can find a way to get those kinds of jobs with green energy, we would have people fighting for the same types of jobs. It would just be, you have to get the general public involved in it, or it's not going to be an issue.
But it becomes a no-brainer, I suppose, if the jobs are there that are comparable. That is a very interesting perspective. Let me take it up with my guest, Daniel. I appreciate your call from Jasper, Indiana. Leon Clark, speak to it. I mean, there's the political pushback that comes from the coal industry, coal miners. Are they roadkill in the scenario that the panel outlines in Berlin, or is there another path that opens up for them?
That's a great question. So I think that that your caller has articulated basically one of the biggest challenges, which is there could be winners and losers. That's true. And clearly it's true that unabated or freely emitting fossil fuel use needs to go down. But in the case of coal and other fossil uses, particularly in electricity, there are options. So carbon dioxide capture and storage is a technology that could be used to allow us to continue to use coal. And in that technology, you produce the electricity, but you take the CO2 and then you pump it underground. And the U.S. actually has looked into this a great deal. And
clean coal.
What's that?
Clean coal, I guess, is the tag. People know that.
It would be clean coal, but beyond just not emitting various particulates and so forth, this is about actually pumping the CO2 underground into saline aquifers and storing it there.
Is that a realistic option that we could have coal miners and green policy sufficient to meet these deadlines?
Well, it's certainly a realistic technology in the sense that we know how to do it. There are questions about this technology and pretty much every technology in terms of what they would mean at scale. And that's one of the things I think people don't entirely appreciate. This trying to address this problem in a growing global economy that might have energy use as much as 3 times or 4 times higher in the future means deploying these technologies at scales we just really haven't thought of before. But also I want to point out one thing that your caller's question raises, which is the key here is that the solutions really need to be customized to local or regional circumstances. So this coal, many countries have coal. Those are countries that, if they're going to be successful, are going to need to be thinking about carbon dioxide capture and storage as a way to use coal still going forward. We talk a lot about nuclear. There's been a lot of concern about that after Fukushima, and Japan, Germany are not going to be using nuclear power, at least at this point. But if you go to China, they have a very different opinion about it. And I think one of the key things for folks to remember is there is no single solution. The solutions really need to be customized to the local circumstances and the local societal priorities.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurdish people, killed thousands in a single day. 12 long years later, Uncle Sam said you can't treat Kurds that way. And furthermore, all Kurds are freedom fighters who'd resist this Iraqi tyranny. So Uncle Sam will give them guns and maybe sometimes ammunition so the brave Kurds can fight until they're free. Meanwhile, in southeastern Turkey, the Turkish army had a unique plan. We'll go burn down 3,000 villages, get rid of what they call Kurdistan. But some of these pesky Kurds decided that they would rather fight instead of die. So Uncle Sam said, "You are terrorists because Turkey is our ally." Yes, geopolitics is confusing. In fact, it can be quite absurd, especially if you value your freedom. You live in Turkey and you are a Kurd. Yes, when Iraqi Kurds are massacred, we say this is genocide. Okay, we armed the army through the 80s, but now we proudly take the Kurdish side. But in Turkey, it's an internal matter, and for us to get involved would be wrong. So we'll sell some tanks and copters to Ankara and hope these poor folks can get along. Yes, geopolitics is confusing, and you can't take the Yankees at their word. At least that's distinctly how it looks if you live in Turkey and you are a Kurd. Yes, when we talk about American interests and it somehow seems that they're not yours, going all over the world, bombing countries and starting up wars, you'd better leave it to the experts. Go on back to your PlayStations, 'cause our foreign policy only makes sense to CEOs of multinational corporations. Yes, geopolitics is confusing, and if you feel like you're not being heard, just imagine how much worse it could be if you lived in Turkey and you were a Kurd.
And now back to Tom Ashbrook and his guests talking about the 15 years left to end civilization's energy failures.
Rob Stevens, let me ask you then two things. First, to our caller's question, in a scenario where we take up this challenge and we do it, we fend off this climate change with aggressive action, are there those $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year jobs for no college education coming in for Daniel and his fellow coal miners somehow? And secondly, if Leon Clark in Berlin is correct, we have to customize all this to local circumstance. That sounds like a patchwork of micro policies. One wonders if they'll add up globally to sufficient change.
Well, first, Tom, to the first of the two questions, I think it's good to keep in mind what's happened to coal use in the United States. So as a result of the fall in the price of natural gas, there has been a drastic shift for the generation of electricity from coal to natural gas,
yep.
Absolutely unprecedented. Now, that taking place...
And a lot of jobs in North Dakota and elsewhere, people may not like fracking, but there have been jobs with it.
That's correct. And so we're seeing a switch there from one sector to another. However, it's also good to keep in mind that the coal industry has not actually been hurt by that, because there's been substitution, less use of coal in the United States and more export of coal from the United States.
So net for the global climate, I'm not so sure about.
That's absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. So that brings us back really to your second question, and that is different countries, different circumstances. But for any country, the benefits of reducing climate change are going to be spread over the world, right? If we take action in Massachusetts or the United States, we pay the cost of taking action, but the benefit, the reduced risk of climate change, is spread absolutely globally. What that means is that for any individual jurisdiction, the benefits of taking action, the direct benefits, will inevitably be less than the direct costs. Even though globally the benefits might be much greater than the cost, which is in fact what we've said in this most recent IPCC report,
okay.
That means international cooperation is required. Countries on their own are not going to do it.
I mean, the old gridlock here was a standoff between rich and poor countries, the poor saying, you want us to do this, pay us to do this, and also between newly industrialized and old industrial powers, who's going to bear the burden here? Leon Clark, you're there in Berlin. Do you see any... break in that gridlock? It really has gummed things up for a long time.
Well, I can't comment on whether there will be a breakthrough in that gridlock. All I can say is that in this report, we've tried to do our best to give a sense, basically if you go back to the underlying document, about where emissions have come from and where they may be coming from in the future and what that implies for what different regions might do. And we've also tried to cast a lot of this within the context of understanding some of the different ethical frameworks by which one might be thinking about understanding how the burdens would be shared. Now, whether that sort of information is, and I actually should add that much of the work that Rob's been looking at is then means to actually facilitate international cooperation. Whether this set of information will actually spur folks to get past the issues that they face, that's a very different question.
Let's go to Blaine in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Blaine, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have two quick points. I find myself in the camp that disagrees with your guess. I do not think our fossil fuel usage is behind climate change. And secondly, in terms of resources, we have limited resources, financially I'm speaking, not energy-wise. My wife and I find ourselves as the 50% of folks that actually pay taxes in this country, so we can't absorb any more costs. I've got three children to raise and educate, so when I hear guests talk about costs being passed on to us, we just can't do it. You know, I think money spent towards providing more clean water for the world, more food sources, I think that takes priority over dubious claims about man-made climate change.
Hey, Blaine, I get the part about a monthly budget and how hard it can be to meet it, and I know exactly how that feels. But when you say you don't think fossil fuels are driving this, you know, you sound like a smart guy. Where do you come up with that? Because all these scientists say it is. So why do you say it's not?
Well, first off, science isn't run on consensus. Facts are facts. Theories are theories. With all due respect to your guests, these are theories, not facts. If you look at how the climate changed in the world from 1900 to 1950, there was climate change there. But if you look at the rate of fossil fuel use, it was obviously less during that time period than it is now.
Let me pick that up right there. Our time is short before the break. I appreciate your call. Leon Clark, speak to that assertion from our citizen caller that, you know, he just doesn't believe it.
Well, I think it's important for all of us to to be able to express a variety of different opinions, and we as scientists welcome a wide variety of opinions about whether how much climate might be changing, whether humans are causing it, and so forth. But at the same time, the scientific consensus is essentially unequivocal, which is that warming of the climate system is happening, and that the human influence is a major portion of this. So, I certainly welcome the notion that that there are various opinions. The science is very much in favor of this happening.
Do you call that a fact now? Our listener doesn't.
Oh, whether it's a fact or not. I would say that the scientific consensus is that it's unequivocal.
That sounds pretty strong. Leon Clark in Berlin, please stand by there. Rob Stavins in Newton, Massachusetts. We're talking about an urgent new call to action on climate change. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about an urgent new call to action on climate change. The new UN report saying we have just 15 years to act to avoid calamity, the risk of major, major environmental changes clicking into gear that would be very hard to reverse. Leon, Rob, it's interesting the range of response online here. People saying, yes, let's go, ready to do it. But a whole range of ideas. Leanne says, I wish I was 80 years old instead of 40. I guess, Leon, she's thinking, you know, she doesn't want to be around for this if we don't get on the stick here. And here's another listener who says, Western societies, Western capitalism are way too self-centered to take action or spend money on a problem that our senior leaders will never see the benefits of. We're not evolved yet to that level of empathy. Rob Stavins, you look at policy. You've seen and listened to this conversation for decades now. The report says the policy conversation is evolving, that the panel sees more readiness to address this challenge than in the past. Do you see that, Rob?
Well, I do. I mean, there's vastly more public attention to the problem, and the United States is an outlier. I know that there's this large degree of climate skepticism of whether or not the problem is real in the U.S. among a subset of the population. That's actually not true in other parts of the world, whether it's Europe or any part or Asia, any parts of the world. It's really concentrated here. So globally, there's much more of a will for action. We're seeing more climate policies in most countries, including in the United States, although they're not enough to put us on the right trajectory to address the magnitude of the threat. I think it's helpful to keep in mind that emissions in the OECD countries, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, more or less the industrialized world, those emissions are flat to declining. The major growth, this rapid growth we're seeing in emissions that's accelerating, is coming from the emerging economies. And I'm not saying this to point fingers, but to understand the nature of the problem. That's China, India, Brazil, Korea, South Africa, Mexico, and Indonesia. These large, rapidly growing economies. So as, you know, I heard Rajendra Pachauri on the recording you had at the beginning of the program say, he talked about a train leaving a station. And my view is that unless they get on the global climate policy train, it's not leaving the station. But that doesn't mean they have to pay for their tickets. These are two different problems. They have
Who's going to pay if they don't? Who will pay?
Well, that's through various policy mechanisms. That's how the industrialized world can be helpful. Because, in fact, it would be much cheaper for us in the richer part of the world to finance emissions reductions in the poor parts of the world than to carry out those same magnitude of emissions reductions here. And that's because we have already have much more efficient economies.
Are you calling China and India poor countries in that equation?
Well, when I use the word poor in that case, but they're really moving into middle-income countries at this point.
But are you saying the U.S. and Europe should pay for China and India's cleanup?
The only way this is going to happen is if those countries are the location of most of the action and if there is some financing mechanism from the Western world. That's correct.
Children of despair, hear their cries of pain, see their empty stare. Do you feel their torment? Have the courage now to dare. Can you feel their heartbeat? Yes, have the heart to care. Have the heart to care. Orphan children of poverty and war, millions who've been stricken with plagues from shore to shore. See the child of famine, so fragile, lost and poor, hunger ravaged children, the children you ignore. Children. Children of the world, can you hear their heartbeat? Can you truly feel what's real? Can you sense their heartbreak? Their suffering, can you feel? Will you make a difference with compassion? Will you heal?
Thank you. compassion. Of bigotry and shame, hear the horsemen coming and see the world in flames. See the dying children all caught up in the game, hear the cries of children and know that we're to blame. Know that we're to blame.
Now for something completely different.